Yeah, so there's actually a bit of similarity with the talk that we just heard. That it's really going to be, what I'm going to be talking about is very specifically one particular context. So the title of my talk is Four-Dimensional Variational Simulation in the Context of Numerical Weather Prediction. Can you hear me? Okay, good. So the outline is, first I'm going to talk about the numerical weather prediction context, because I guess as in a lot of other fields, we tend to have a lot of jargon or terminology that probably we're the only people using. So kind of tell you what that is first. And then I'll talk about four-dimensional variational simulation, and at the end of it on constrained variational data simulation. So first of all, a bit about the context. So here comes the first, bit of jargon is atmospheric data analysis. What do we mean by that? Well, we actually have, what we have are a lot of measurements of the atmosphere, and they are from instruments that are sampling imperfectly and irregularly in space and time. So we can imagine some kind of distribution of observations like this. But what we really want is some representation of the state of the atmosphere on some nice regular model grid. So something like this. So what we call this going from here to here is the process of doing an analysis. But we also call this state that we get at the end, the product, we also call that an analysis as well. So it's actually a verb here as well as a noun there. And where are our measurements coming from for weather forecasting? Well, they're coming from what we call the Global Observing System, managed by the World Meteorological Organization. And measurements are collected all over the world continuously, and they're beamed to our local weather centers. In our case, it's the Canadian Meteorological Center, which is located in Montreal. So we have a variety of measurements. The backbone of our observing system are actually these. These are called radiosondes, and they're small instrument packages which are attached to helium balloons. And these small packages actually measure temperature, moisture, pressure, and as the balloon rises, you can track it and get horizontal winds as well. So these sample vertically through the atmosphere until the balloon eventually breaks, and then you've lost your measurements at that point. You also have measurements from the land, the surface, from land stations, from ships and buoys as well. We also have a lot of very temporally continuous information from things like weather radars, as well as aircraft, and remotely sensed measurements from polar orbiting and geostationary satellites. So what these remotely sensed measurements are doing is basically sensing the outgoing radiance at the top of the atmosphere. So they're sensing vertically integrated quantities. So with all of those different types of measurements, what we can do is take a look at some of the examples of the data coverage that we have. This is taken from 1 6-hour period for January 6, 2008, 12 universal time. This is our radiosonde network at 12Z, and you can see here that the coverage looks really good, especially in the northern hemisphere and over the continents. But if you look at the tropics or the southern hemisphere oceans, it's not that great. But the one thing that's really nice is that these are sampling vertically in time, although they're only happening about twice a day, 0 and 12. Universal time. In terms of aircraft measurements, it looks like we have a lot of measurements over the continental U.S. because we have a lot of ascents and descents there, and also over Europe as well. And then we have these ribbons of, tracks when the airplanes are at cruising altitude. So there we get only information at a single vertical level. So again, lots of gaps over the oceans here. Now here, this looks really good because this is from polar orbiting satellites. We have four different satellites here shown by these colors. And if you look at all the tracks, and this is again in a 6-hour window, it looks like amazing coverage horizontally, and it is pretty good horizontally. However, vertically, as we mentioned earlier, we tend to be dealing with quantities that are integrated over the whole depth of the atmosphere. And again, the same thing with the geostationary satellites. If you look at the pattern, again, we have lots of measurements here, particularly with good coverage in the tropics. Not so great outside of the tropics, although in this particular example, we're also showing a bit from polar orbiting satellites as well. These are cloud drift winds. So it's an empirical algorithm where you look at an imager and you look at how the cloud has evolved in time and sort of deduce the motion, horizontal motion vector, at the level of the cloud, assuming you know what that is. So what we can do is look at the size of the problem that we're dealing with. We can look at the size of our observation vector by looking at all of the different types of measurements we have. So I did a really order of magnitude type calculation here based on that previous slide and other data which didn't show you. So multiplied by the number of reports times the number of variables that were observed times the number of vertical levels. And you get about 1.6 million bits of information every time we do an analysis. And in terms of our state vector, what do we want? Well, yep. When I said bits of information, sorry, I didn't mean technically at all. I just mean pieces or actually items or, you know what I mean. Sorry about that. In terms of what we want to know, our state vector, our operational forecast model right now at CMC, it's a grid point model, so we can describe it in terms of the number of grid points in the east-west, north-south, vertical direction, and number of prognostic variables, two horizontal wind components, temperature, and moisture. And that is 10 to the 8. So effectively, we want 10 to the 8 pieces of information, or I don't know what you want to call it. And this is what's going to happen this year. We're going to go up to 50% bigger by increasing the vertical extent of the model. So basically, we have about two orders of magnitude fewer bits of information than what we really need. So there's no way. Ideally, it would be great if we could actually go from our observations and interpolate to our model grid. But obviously, we can't do that because we have way too few information. So the problem is really underdetermined, and we need more information. And this is one of the fundamental issues in atmospheric data simulation. So what do? Well, we do something which we call optimal interpolation. I don't know if other fields use that terminology as well. But what we do is we combine two sources of information. In our case, it's the observations here, which we call an n by 1 vector, with our background, which is coming from a short-term model forecast. And in our problem, it's typically a 6 or 12-hour forecast. And the reason is because the weather forecast models are good enough that the quality of a short-term 6 or 12-hour forecast is roughly comparable to the size of the observation errors. So we can combine these two sources of information, and this is an n by 1 vector where n is about 2 orders of magnitude bigger than m. So we can simply linearly combine these two sources of information. But for us, we tend to write it in this form as the difference between the observation and our background state mapped into observation space. So this operator here, we call it an observation operator, and it can be nonlinear because we're going actually from the model space in location, but also to the variables of the observation. So in the case of the radiance measurements, we're actually going to integrate radio transfer equations to go from our model temperature, say, to the radiance at the top of the column of the atmosphere. So what we want to do then is we usually apply a minimization or an optimization principle where we want to minimize the analysis errors and solve for the weights so that these errors are minimized. So we can do that if we have extra information. Basically, if we know something about the stochastic processes that generate both the forecast and the observation. So we assume that we know these things in terms of both their bias and the error covariances. So if we do that, then we can simply solve for K by minimizing the analysis error variance with respect to this K matrix. And we can write an expression here which depends on a couple of things. This is our background or forecast error covariance matrix here. And this is our observation error covariance matrix. And this is now a linearization of our observation operator around our background state. So the problem here is that we really can't do this matrix inversion because this is roughly a million by a million. So what we have to do, historically what we did, say back in the 80s or so, is you have to find some way to deal with this problem. And ultimately, the real key to solving this problem was to limit the number of observations that we are dealing with. So what you do is solve, instead of solving for the entire analysis vector, the whole world at one time, you solve for one point, grid point, and you limit the observations to the closest observations, or the ones which where the forecast error has the highest correlation with the forecast error at your analysis grid point. Because it's this forecast error correlation is going to drop off with distance. And at some point, the observation far enough away is not going to have any bearing on the analysis at that grid point. So if you limit yourself to some small number of observations, typically on the order of about 100, now you can invert this matrix. So that's what was done historically. Now, one other thing that's very interesting about this equation is that if you substitute this form into here, what you get is this is the leftmost term, and everything else here multiplied together just gives us a vector. So if you look at it that way, what you see is that this difference, which we call the analysis increment, and that describes the information of the observations on our model grid space, these analysis increments must line the subspace spanned by the columns of B. So this is really important then, how we specify our forecast error covariances. Because that's a lot of our physics is going to come in here, and that's going to determine the filtering properties of our assimilation system. So these are the fundamental issues then in atmospheric data simulation. The problem is underdetermined by at least a couple of orders of magnitude. We don't have enough observations to define the state. So clearly we don't have enough observations to define these very important forecast error covariances that we need. So we have to model them statistically using only a few parameters. So historically we did things like make assumptions of stationarity, isotropy, homogeneity, things that very likely aren't true, but you need to do them so that you have enough or few enough parameters that you can estimate from the data. So the problem is we have to approximate our forecast error covariances, and on top of that, even if we didn't, even if we had billions and billions of observations, theoretically we can never know these forecast error covariances anyway, because by definition our forecast error is the difference of our forecast with the truth, and we're never going to know that ever. So these are critically important, yet we're never going to know them, and this covariance is going to determine properties of our solution. And of course we're dealing with huge, very large scale problems, the state on the order of 10 to the 8, and we're dealing with nonlinear chaotic dynamics. But in the end, we have an assimilation cycle, and we've been doing this operationally for about, I don't know, five decades. So we have two steps. We have what we call the analysis step, where we combine information of observations from our short-term forecast, valid at the time of the observation, into some assimilation scheme. We also provide information about these error sources, and we typically assume the errors are unbiased, and we supply information about the forecast and observation error covariances. The output is then what we call our analysis, our estimate of the state of the atmosphere on our model grid, and that analysis then is used as an initial condition for launching a forecast as input into our weather forecasting model, and we get a forecast. And we can create forecasts as long as we want. On the news, you'll see things like anything from one day to maybe 10 days. But we can also produce a forecast for the next 6 hours. And then we can repeat the whole cycle 6 hours later by combining that forecast with the observation. And this continues indefinitely. Now talk about variational data simulation and how we got into this area. Now in our field, when we solve this problem, we call that optimal interpolation. But we could have got the same answer by minimizing this cost function. And in our field, we call this three-dimensional variational simulation, even though mathematically it's the same. And the reason is because of the practical approximations that we make to solve the problem. Remember, in this case, we wanted to invert this matrix, and we had to make some assumptions, which the biggest one was this issue of data selection, where we were only using a certain amount of data. And what that was doing, and also we were producing the analysis only at sequentially every grid point, one after the other. And the problem is that that creates noise in the analysis. So you get a solution here and here and here, and you can see that it's going to introduce a lot of noise. And that created a lot of other problems. But what you can do by writing the problem this way is solve some of these other issues. You can actually assimilate all of the observations over the whole world all at once because you have a scalar cost function here. So all we have to do is compute the difference between the observations and the background, project it onto the observation locations, and weight by the observation error covariance matrix here. So that's just a scalar. And this is the departure from our background state. And of course, we need this term because our problem is underdetermined. That's why we need to still be constrained to the background state. So that's a major, practical difference between these two algorithms. And it also means that our observations and models can be nonlinearly related. And of course, they could be here as well, but the difficulty is that we had to compute this. And this is our forecast error covariance matrix in observation space. So trying to figure that out in radiant space when you're used to dealing with temperatures and things, that's pretty tricky. Whereas here, all we have to do is compute this difference. And it's very easy to go from our temperatures to, say, a radiance or wind speed or something else. And the other big thing by solving it this way is that we don't need these matrix inverses. And, of course, you will notice that there are some here. But I'm saying that we don't need them because here we typically assume that our observation errors are uncorrelated, which this is a diagonal matrix. And that assumes then that observation errors from different types of instruments are not correlated, and that's kind of reasonable. And even observations from the same type of instrument is not correlated. Probably not as reasonable, especially for satellite measurements. But nevertheless, that's what we all do at this point. This one here also has a matrix inverse, and that's a full matrix. It's certainly not diagonal, so we can't. We have another trick to deal with that one. And I guess we call it preconditioning. It's related to what you saw earlier. So we have our cost function here that we want to minimize, but we don't want to compute this B matrix, so we make a change of control variable. So we minimize with respect to these departures from our forecaster background state here. We call these our increments, as we did before. And then we make this linear change of control variable where L is the A square root matrix of our forecast error covariance matrix. So now if we minimize instead with respect to this chi rather than x, then the first term of our new cost function is going to look like this. And then we don't have matrix inverses. We only have to be able to do this transformation. And then you'll notice also that the Hessian of the cost function here is related to the inverse covariance matrices that we have, for the forecast and the observation errors. After we make the change of variable, the Hessian is the identity matrix because we have this term first, plus some other term which is going to be related to this term here. So if we actually had no observations at all, then of course we wouldn't have this term at all. And the Hessian would be very nice. It would be the identity, and our condition number would be great. However, the more observations we get, or the more accurate, because this second term here is going to depend on this inverse of the covariance matrix. So the more obs or the more accurate obs that we get, this type of change of variable for the sake of preconditioning is not so great. So we have to rely a bit on our optimization algorithm to help us in the preconditioning as well. Now, we can also extend this problem to the time dimensions, and these three-dimensional schemes make sense when all of the observations are taken at the same time. And historically, the backbone of our observing system were these radiosondes that were sent up over the whole world at the same time, but only twice a day. Actually, four times, but very few people did it four times a day. But now we have a lot more measurements of different types. Temporally continuous measurements such as instruments on satellites, wind profilers, aircraft, radar, things like that. So we want to be able to take advantage of measurements that are temporally continuous. So what we can do is extend the problem then to four dimensions. So we imagine a time interval here where we have a model running through, and we have n model time steps in this assimilation window. And we have some background state here, which if you integrate it in time, you get this dash trajectory. We call that the background trajectory. And we have some observations distributed in this assimilation window, and this background trajectory doesn't fit the observations very well. So what we want is to be able to modify this initial condition so we find a new initial condition, so that when you integrate that, you get what we call the analysis trajectory, and that's going to better fit the observations. So to do that, first of all, we have to define what we mean by fit, and it's the same thing that we saw before in the 3D var case, except now what we have here is over every time step, we're going to look at the difference between the observations and the background state at that point in time. So this is going to involve an integration in time of this background trajectory to the time of the observation. Now we can illustrate fairly easily the benefit of temporal information using a very simple example. This is from a one-dimensional shallow water model. So this is the non-dimensional periodic domain, X, and we're showing here the height of the fluid apart from some mean fluid depth. And at initial time, we have a sinusoidal function for the fluid depth. And we also have wind field, which not showing here at all, but what's happening is you're getting an advection, but also a convergence. So in the middle time, this field has moved to the right, but you also see a form like a jump here, and we call that a front. And by the final time, this front has propagated further to the right, and it's diminished a bit. It's not as strong because of the diffusion in the model. So what we can do then is start with an initial condition which is wrong, and it results in misplacing the front. So this is our dashed solution here, and our reference solution was the solid one. And what we can do then is a 4D var assimilation problem where we have information at only one grid point. There's 128 grid points across here, and the one grid point we're going to use is this, the one right in the middle of the domain. And we're going to use all three variables, so two horizontal wind components and the height of the fluid as well. So you do one 4D var assimilation with one station here, and the solution is shown here. You see that the solution is improved in the vicinity of the observing station, but also downstream. You actually were able to correct the position of the front. And the reason is because at the middle time, this front actually passed over the observing station. So you're able to take advantage of the temporal information content of the observations. And just for comparison, if you had done a 3D var solution just at this final time, the only thing you could have done is improve the solution in the vicinity of the observation. So what do we need an algorithm, basically, to do this. And it's pretty similar to what Bartosz actually described as well. So what we do is first we have to compute our cost. So to do that, we need to get the state at every point in time where we have observation. So we first run our weather forecast model forward in this assimilation window from some initial conditions to get this trajectory. Then we compute the cost, just a scalar function. Then we have to compute the gradient of that cost with respect to our initial conditions. So our control variable are the initial conditions, so it is size of about 10 to the 8. Then we want to find some step size and then modify our state so that we get to a position where we have lower cost. So how do we do that? And again, you've already seen this, I guess, in the previous talk. What we do is we start off with a weather forecast model. We have a state at time step k, and it produces a state at time step k plus 1. But for that, we derive a full second model, a linearized, tangent linear model. And what it describes is the evolution of perturbations in time around this evolving trajectory. And then we can define the adjoint model with respect to this tangent linear model for a certain inner product. And the way that that's useful is if we look at arbitrary variations in the cost function, by definition, it's the inner product of the gradient of the cost function with respect to the state at a certain time and the variations of the state at that time summed over all time steps. But this variation is given through the tangent linear model, it's related to the variation at the initial state. And then we can apply the adjoint operator and bring all of these operators over to the other side and get this expression. Then we bring the summation inside here. And finally, we can compare now to the definition, which is the gradient of the cost with respect to the initial condition with the inner product with the variation of the initial conditions. And comparing these two terms, we now have a way of computing the gradient of the cost function with respect to the initial condition. What we have to do is integrate our adjoint model backwards in time. And here it looks like it's N model, backward model integration. But in fact, because it's a linear integration, we only have to do this once. And we're forcing here by this, which is just the misfit between the state and the observations at a given point in time. It is. This is changing in time, but what I meant by this here is linearized. So once it is a function of time, but once we have this, we know this. So it's defined with respect to a specific background state. So when we have the adjoint model, it's defined with respect to this. So if we integrate that backward in time, if we do that once, starting from time step n, or if we do that starting from time step n minus 1, it's the same. These things are not changing in that interval. These don't change. So that's why instead of doing that n times backwards like that, you can just do it at this point, and then it's just like gathering the terms all together, and then you add the forcing in. I probably didn't explain that very well. But trust me, that's true. So the question is, how do we develop these the tangent linear and adjoint model? Well, what we do is actually go subroutine by subroutine, and we're talking about enormous codes. Our weather forecast models are, I don't even want to count how many lines there are. I don't know, at least in the hundreds of thousands of lines and thousands of subroutines. So if we have some subroutine, first we linearize it with respect to our control variables, which are the initial conditions. And so we can write it like this, where now L is our linearized subroutine. We have some inputs and some outputs. So then we can define an adjoint subroutine for every subroutine that we have. And we define it with respect to some given inner product. And in our case, our inner product, we use the Euclidean norm or the dot product, and that's because we have a grid point model. And it's easy to show that in that case, our adjoint is simply the transpose. So it's starting from this tangent linear subroutine, we can actually just write it backwards. So we actually start at the bottom, go backwards, and take each statement line by line and write out what the matrix equation is, and then do the transpose. And you can actually start to get very automated doing that. In fact, there are compilers and stuff that'll do that now. But when we had to develop our code, those compilers weren't ready, so we actually did it by hand. And I was one of the people that did it. So now we have a method of computing the gradient, we still need a minimization algorithm. And here we don't write our own. We leave it to you guys, the experts. And in this case, we're kind of all actually using the same thing. Many weather centers, not just the Canadians, are using this algorithm from the French, M1QN3. It's a limited memory quasi-Newton technique. And it's specifically designed for very large-scale problems. And that's where the information is on the website. And it's nice also because it does some preconditioning as well. So if we want to solve problems repeatedly, we can save information about the preconditioner for the next time we solve the problem. So the 40-bar algorithm, as we've described it, effectively assumes that the numerical weather prediction model is perfect. I don't know if that was obvious, but so I'll go back here and say why. Because what we're doing is we're saying that when we integrate our initial condition out in this assimilation period, we're believing that we should be able to fit these observations. And you can imagine that if this assimilation window was long enough, say 5 days, because you know you can't believe the 5-day forecast, right? So you can imagine out here at 5 days, we don't even expect that forecast should even match the observations. So the fact that we are believing this means we are making an assumption that our forecast model is good enough during that period. So we're effectively assuming that the forecast model is perfect. But what that allows us to do is develop complex nonlinear relationships between the analysis variables and between the observation, the observed and the analysis variables. And this is great because it helps in reducing this underdeterminacy problem simply through advection of information in time according to the wind, but also, as you'll see in a minute, through scale nonlinear scale interactions. A drawback is then you have to develop these huge models, the tangent linear and adjoint models, and now they're the assimilation is intimately tied to the forecast model. And in our job, we're always trying to be supposed to be improving our forecast and through the improvements in the forecast model. So you can imagine that every time we change this model, it's a pain to be adjusting these as well. That's what we have to do. And this is expensive. So in each of these iterations, we have to integrate the forward model, and we have to integrate the adjoint model backwards in time. And the adjoint model is about 1 to 2 times the cost of running the forward model, so roughly 2 to 3 times the cost of running the forecast model in that assimilation window for each iteration. We're going to do about 50 of them. So we're talking 100, 150 times running the forecast just to get the initial condition right. So why would we do that? Because there are a lot of advantages, and I just mentioned some of them, the flow, the advection in time. But another advantage is that the information is going to be spread, actually, according to the flow. And we can show this here by looking at, I shouldn't have used this terminology, they call it structure functions. But what we can do is do an assimilation problem with a single observation, and then look at the analysis increments, because that's going to tell you how that information is being spread. So if we use a single observation, this is a scalar. This is just in observation space, the observation error covariance matrix and the background error covariance matrix in ob space. This is all a scalar for a single observation here. And this matrix here, which is the observation operator, this becomes a vector for a single observation. And in fact, if you choose the observed variable to be the same as a model variable and put it at a grid point, actually H is going to be very simple. It's going to be zeros, a vector of zeros with 1, 1. And that shows you that what you're doing here is picking out a column of this background error covariance matrix. So what you see is you do one assimilation of one ob, and you compute this difference between the analysis and the forecast, and what you're going to be looking at is a column of this forecast error covariance matrix. That's in 3D var. Now in 4D var, you also have to worry about when your observation occurred. So now you have to integrate from your initial condition to the time of the observation, and that means that here our observation operator also includes the time integration. So we have the adjoint now of our propagator here. And then we want to look at the analysis increments at the time of the observation. So this difference, we can approximate this difference here by integrating this by our propagator as well. So now what we're seeing here is with a single observation, we're going to see how this looks like. And what is this? Well, it's actually our background error, our forecast error covariance matrix, but propagated to the time of our observation through the full model, tangent linear model dynamics. So we can look at what happens here. So these are the increments for G potential height. It's basically the height of a pressure surface at two levels. This is mid-tropospheric level. This is near the surface. This is at the end of a 24-hour assimilation period, and this is how the information of one observation is being spread. And in a 3D scheme, we have these concentric circles, and that's because of the assumptions we made about homogeneity and isotropy and stationarity, all that. Now, in the 4D case, we actually start at the beginning of our assimilation period with the same 3D covariance matrix, but within that assimilation window, it's being evolved implicitly in time. So now you get structures which are anisotropic, non-homogeneous, and flow-dependent. So, in fact, what's going on here is a storm is developing, and this is the warm sector here of the cyclone, and there's a front along here. So the information where you'd expect it to be connected, like in the warm sector and along the warm front, it is. We get increments of the same size, same sign. So that means that in the 40 var single obs experiment, you can demonstrate that the shape of the analysis increments depends on the location of the observation, not just in vertically, but also horizontally as well. And the spreading of the information is flow dependent. So why does 40 var beat 3D var? Well, a number of different reasons. 4D VAR is using the obs at their actual time of measurement, whereas 3D VAR is treating all the obs in some window, in our case a 6-hour window, as though they're valid in the middle of the window. 4D VAR uses all temporally continuous observations within this 6-hour window, whereas 3D VAR will only use the ones that are close enough to the middle of the time. And 4D VAR can actually implicitly evolve these covariances in time during that assimilation window, whereas 3D VAR assumes static error covariances. But there's also a lot of complications due to the fact that we're dealing with nonlinear dynamics. And one of the things we'd like to know is how long should that assimilation window be? Well, that depends on your tangent linear model. We have our nonlinear model, and we described already the tangent linear model, which is just the derivative of this, or the variation of this state, describing the evolution of variations of the state. Now, the nonlinear evolution of perturbation is actually given by this difference here. And this nonlinear difference has not only first order, but second order and all higher order terms. If this nonlinear difference if the first part of it is well described by the tangent linear model, then this difference here is only second order and higher. So if that's small with respect to the first order evolution of errors, then we know our tangent linear model is valid. And that, of course, depends on the problem that you're looking at, even within atmospheric physics. So if we're talking about the global forecasting problem, so we're talking about large-scale processes, say, evolution of storms, then this is going to be on the order of about a day or so. These are early papers, so these are a bit optimistic. Here they're talking about shallow water models. They found 2 days. And again, very low resolution primitive equation. This is like related to Navier-Stokes equations. This is, again, they got 2 days, but this is really low resolution compared to what we're running right now. And they have about T1000, truncation 1000 in at the European Center. And for mesoscale systems, these are limited area models where you're trying to resolve processes like thunderstorms, convective complexes, where you get smaller scale structures like fronts, things like that. Here you have much faster processes, so the tangent linear model will be valid for a much shorter time. And of course, we can even get very highly nonlinear dynamics. And this is a model that's often used in meteorology to test data assimilation schemes because it has very highly nonlinear dynamics, and a lot of our schemes are making assumptions of linearity at some level, so we expect them to fail or not work at some point. So this is from Lorentz 1963 equations. They are related to meteorological, equations, but highly, highly truncated. And the attractor is shown here, or trajectories in phase space, and you get this famous butterfly picture. Now, if you do a 4D VAR on that problem, what you can show, they've shown in this paper, this is one variable x, and this is time. For a certain assimilation window, and this is some non-dimensional number, you can find a solution which fits your observations, the crosses here, very well, and you can't see the difference between the reference and the analysis. But if you launch your forecast from that point, at some point the forecast fails. And the reason, or the way that you see it, the reason for the problem is that if you plot the cost function here, this is x now, that's a cost function, as a function here for different assimilation windows, you see that what's happening is that you're starting to get local minima or multiple minima. So as the assimilation window gets longer and longer, you're starting to get many, many more local minima. In fact, you can get thousands of local minima. So that's a problem because we don't want one of these local solutions. We want the global solution. And our optimization algorithm is going to give us a local minimum, so we got to do something else to make sure that we're going to get the solution we want. So what we've seen then is we don't want the assimilation window to be too long, because then our tangent linear model is not going to be very accurate. It's not going to be a very good description. But on the other hand, we also don't want the assimilation window to be too short either. And again, the reason is because of nonlinear interactions. What can happen is the large square flow through nonlinear nonlinear interaction is actually going to develop smaller scale structures. And this is what's shown here in this paper. The ability of the 4D VAR scheme to actually fill in these small scales through the downscale energy cascade. So this is a simple, basically, vorticity type equation. And in this assimilation experiment, they have a perfect model and perfect observations. So the only challenge is that the initial condition is completely wrong. It's completely decorrelated from the truth. So what they're plotting here now is the spectrum of the error, the energy spectrum. So initially, this is the background. They have a spectrum that looks like this. And this is the horizontal wave number here. So large error wave number 2. Now, as the assimilation or the minimization proceeds, this is number of iterations. As you get to 30 and 120 and even down to 210 and 270, you can see that what's happening is you're getting information, or you're getting the solution on the large scale first. And then by the end, you still haven't really done much on your small scales. But you've done a lot on your large scales. And that depends on the length of your assimilation window. Here it's 3 days. And of course, everything here is non-dimensionalized. So this is an approximation to something atmospheric. And the nonlinear time scale in this is 9, which is roughly around this 3 days. This 9 refers to these time units down here. But if you have a really long window, say 12 days, what happens here is that you're really not even getting your large scales right. And on these smaller scales, you actually diverge. So what's happening is you're just getting into one of these local minima, and you're not getting the solution at all. But what you can show then, what they do is they specify the truth or the reference on large scales only, so for these first 5 wave numbers here, and then do the assimilation. So there's completely no information about these smaller scales. And what they find then is as you proceed in your minimization, this is for a short assimilation window compared to the nonlinear time scale. And now you can see that you can do pretty well on your large scale, and that's great because they're the observed scales. But you can also get some information here on these unobserved scales. And this is through this downscale energy cascade. And it's even better, actually, if you allow more time for nonlinear interactions to occur. So if you get, actually, to the nonlinear time scale of 3 days, this improvement here is even better than it was there. But if you keep going, if you get too long, then, of course, you have this upscale propagation of the errors here. And this becomes quite clear here when you're at 9 days. And now the errors here are even propagating to our observed scales as well. So what that means then is, in a way, it gives us a way to make the whole 4D VAR problem actually tractable. Because as I've described it right now, it's not even feasible. So what was proposed in 1994 is this so-called incremental approach. Because we know from the physical system that the tangent linear model is only going to be valid for large scales. So for our global forecast problem, maybe for these really large scales on the order of, say, 100 kilometers or larger, but not for very small scale processes like convection or things like that. So what we can do then is then solve only for these analysis increments, that is a departure from the background state, and solve for that at lower resolution. So that means we can write our cost function then in terms of these increments, what I was calling analysis increments, which are departure from the background state, and effectively use lower resolution, which is then going to filter scales and processes that we know we're not going to get anyway with our tangent linear model. Then the forecast model in the cost function is then not our full nonlinear forecast model, but our tangent linear model. But this is the real key. Now our cost function is purely quadratic. So now we're guaranteed we're going to get to the minimum. And the use of our lower resolution, of course, makes this whole process now feasible. But we're still going to compare to the measurements at the full resolution of the model. And, of course, the cost, there's always a cost, is that we're going to solve a series of problems now, a series of 4D VAR problems, where effectively we're taking our nonlinear cost function and fitting a bunch of quadratic cost functions to that and solving those and hoping that we converge. So I can talk a little bit about constrained variational assimilation. If we actually take our analysis and use it as an initial condition, launch our forecast model, actually what we're going to get is a lot of noise. So if you look at surface pressure tendency, this is time, you would expect to see something like this. Lots of noise here. And the reason is because we have errors. Our observations are not perfect, and they're also sensing scales, which we probably can't resolve in our models anyway. So when we get our analysis, we have scales that we can't really deal with. And this leads to these noisy forecasts, which we're going to see in precipitation and things like surface pressure tendency. And of course, forecasters don't like that at all. And another big problem is that we use our six-hour forecast to quality control the observations at the next analysis. So if you have a crazy forecast like this, and your observation is really telling you it's something like this, then you could end up rejecting good observations or accepting these bad observations. So for these reasons, it's really important to filter your analysis for these high-frequency waves. And the reason why people filter is because we know in general that there is an approximate mass-wind balance in the mid-troposphere, in the mid-latitudes. And the way you see that here, we're looking at basically the height of a pressure surface in the mid-troposphere. So those are height contours here. And the wind vectors are nicely lined parallel to these right around the low and the high pressure centers. Now, they're not exactly parallel because the equations of motions are not that simple. This balance is only approximate. It's not exact. And also, as you go down to the tropics, such a nice balance doesn't exist either. But historically, anyway, most people were doing these forecasts out in the mid-latitudes. So they were happy enough to say that the atmosphere is pretty balanced and don't worry about the tropics. So we do a separate initialization step where we try to find a balanced state, which is nice for balanced with respect to the forecast model. So does 4DVAR inherently produce balanced analyses? Well, actually, 4DVAR tries to find the model state which best fits the observations in a time window. And when this was first being proposed, I remember people saying that we don't have to worry about balanced initialization anymore because 4DVAR finds a nice model state. But what they forgot was that the model itself contains many modes and at its disposal to fit the observations. So it has not only these nice, slowly rotating or evolving modes, which are highly rotational, but they also have very high-frequency modes as well. And what you're going to do, if the observations have high-frequency signals, which they will, because the atmosphere does, then the model is going to use as many of these high-frequency waves as it needs to fit the observations. So, of course, the very first experiments with 4DVAR found all of these nice high-frequency waves, which is not what we want. So what we have to do is apply some kind of constraint. And effectively, what we're drawing here conceptually are these contours of the cost function. And the center here is where we want to get to. That's our observed observations. And we're drawing it in some model space here where we're looking at rotational modes, which are the meteorologically significant modes, and these are the high-frequency modes along this direction. And this is our closest point to the measurements, but in reality, we have some subspace of model solutions that we like because these are going to evolve nice and slowly, so we're going to call this some slow manifold. And what we really want is the model state that lies on here but is close to the observations, and that point is actually here, C. And we can solve this using some strong constraint procedure solved directly for this point, C, if we can define what our subspace is here. Now, in practice, this doesn't tend to work very well because when we define our subspace, we do it only approximately. And if we don't complete this projection right onto our subspace, then we're still back in our full model space and we can still use all these fast modes to reconstruct all of the noise in the observation. So it doesn't tend to work in practice. So what we tend to do is a weak constraint. So we take our original 4DVAR problem and add a penalty term. So this is a penalty parameter, and this is a quadratic form here of our constraints. And this is our unconstrained problem again, and this is contours parallel to our constraint. So for a small value of our penalty parameter, what happens is that the unconstrained cost function gets deformed. So our solution here gets us close to this constraint. Now, if we want, we could solve the problem again and increase the penalty, the size of the penalty parameter and slowly, hopefully, converge to the strong constraint solution. But because we're dealing with such an expensive system anyway, you can guess that we don't do that. We just put one small value for the penalty parameter and just empirically guess and see what gives us a good solution. So sort of getting towards the end here, we talked about the disadvantages of 40 bar, that the model was specific to a forecast model and you had to develop these tangentlinear and adjoint models. But not entirely true. At the UK Met Office, they use what they call perturbation forecast, because all you need really is some way that some model in which you believe describes the evolution of errors of the model. We also said that we assume that the forecast model is perfect, and again, mathematically, you don't have to make that assumption. You could do a weak constraint formulation and for the model errors, and people, again, at the European Center are looking at that. But the bigger issue is, what is the model error? And we don't know that, not even the bias, let alone the error covariance of that. And also that it's a really expensive proposition, but on the other hand, people keep saying that computing power keeps increasing. So what are the challenges? Obtaining fast, efficient, large-scale optimization routines, because whenever we look at the literature, we see these tiny problems, which size is about 10 or 100 or something. And how do we get the analysis there? We want not just the analysis, we want to know how accurate that is. That's related to the Hessian of our cost function. But our minimization algorithm is only going to give us a bit of information about that Hessian in only a few columns, maybe a couple of eigenvalues. So really what we want is this full inverse of the Hessian matrix. And if we have that, then we could even get our forecast error. We would know how accurate our forecast is as well by propagating this analysis error covariance matrix in time. And then we could actually cycle the whole process. So instead of every time we do a 40 bar, we go back to our stationary covariances for forecast error, we could actually use the information in the assimilation window and then update and get a better estimate of our forecast error covariance and do that. And that would be ideal, but we're not there yet. And as I mentioned already, how on earth do we estimate and incorporate model error? So this is just to show you that all the weather centers that are using 4DVAR operationally, and this is all pretty recent stuff since about 2000, so Europe, France, Japan, UK, and Canada. To summarize, the atmospheric data simulation problem is characterized by huge nonlinear systems and insufficient observations. And because the math of the linear estimation problem is well known, then, at least in my opinion, the key to making progress is using understanding of the atmospheric physics or the dynamics to make the right approximations. That's it.